Docs Clubhouse with Eric Lineberg, the Doctor of Baseball, only on blogtalkradio.com. The Doctor is in.
Welcome. You are in the clubhouse with the Doctor of Baseball, Eric Lineberg. And today we have a very special guest for you. This man has written three best-selling books. He refers to it as the Baseball Trilogy. But he's also a Grammy-nominated songwriter and an award-winning documentarian for Beatles Stories. A documentary he did a few years ago, won all kinds of awards. And welcome Seth Swirsky today.
Thank you so much.
Great to have you here.
Thank you.
Let me start off by asking you about the Baseball Letters, the first of your three books.
Yes.
How did you come up with the idea for that?
Well, you know, it was 1994, the summer of 94, and my first son was born, Julian.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the players went on strike. It wasn't a great time for baseball. It was one of the low lights. I'm sure everybody would like to forget it. But I missed the game. So I started writing letters to all these old players, and I discovered there were players that were alive when Ty Cobb played and Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig. And before I knew it, I went to my mailbox, and there were all these letters back. Every day I'd get 10, 12, sometimes 20 letters back from players.
Did that surprise you?
It did at the beginning, for sure. And then I thought, wow, if these guys are writing me back, I should... You know, sometimes they were, you know, the guy who played third base when Babe Ruth supposedly called his shot in the 1932 World Series, Woody English.
Wow. Yes.
And he's saying, you know, he was 89 years old when he wrote me back. And his handwriting wasn't, you know, that steady. But he's saying, no, I was there. I was 90 feet away. He goes, Babe Ruth did not call his shot. And you felt his passion.
Right.
And it was fantastic. And so I thought, wow, these guys were there. And I gotta get them, you know, to write down their view of this stuff. And before you know it, then I started writing to my favorite players from my favorite era, you know, mm-hmm. the late 60s and 70s. And I'm writing to Reggie Jackson and getting letters back from him, and Al Kaline and all these great, the 69 Mets, anybody on the Mets, Tom Seaver and those guys.
Right.
And so you can only imagine, every day was Christmas. You know, I'd be getting a present every day when you get a letter from these guys. And it turned into my first book, Baseball Letters.
Right.
Before I knew it, I was on the Today Show and Good Morning America and doing book signings around the country and just having such a good time.
Well, at that period, I think that's when I first met you about 20 years ago, when you were on the book tour.
Yeah.
And let me ask you this. Did the success of the book surprise you?
It really did. You know, I just really wanted to share the joy. I was having pure joy,
right.
You know, getting letters from baseball players. And, you know, when you look at them and you see it in their own handwriting, you're getting kind of the flavor of who they are.
Right.
You know, so I really wanted to share it. And so when other people, I got a lot of letters from people.
Right.
Saying, you know, this was the best present I ever got. You can only imagine how that feels, you know, when people were given that at Christmas. And it just felt so good that I was able to share the fun that I was having. That's always such a joyful feeling.
Well, and I know a lot of people in my business get that same feeling when they're able to bring a friend or a family member and introduce them to someone who they've admired for so many years and do it as a surprise or something.
Oh, yeah.
Now, Baseball Letters does what it does, and it launches into orbit, so to speak.
Yeah.
So then what happens next?
Well, you know, all that time, I'm a songwriter, you know, and I was signed to a major publishing company. So I was writing songs for a lot of different recording artists at the time, Celine Dion and Smokey Robinson and different people, and having a great time doing that. And I thought, wow, I didn't know I was going to have this book came out and all great, but then there was demand for a second book.
Right.
So I'm driving down Sunset Boulevard in L.A., and the title just popped into my head. Every Pitcher Tells a Story. And I thought, you know what? I remember now that pitchers have the most remarkable memories. That you could ask a guy who's 75, 80 years old right now, what happened in a certain at-bat, and he'll tell you, I threw him a curve and it was just off the plate.
Right.
You know, pitchers have remarkable memories for that stuff. And instead of doing a book that was Baseball Letters part two.
Right.
I always like to change it up and do something different. And that's how Every Pitcher Tells a Story came in. And that actually did better than Baseball Letters. So,
right.
You know, all of a sudden, baseball became something kind of big in my life. And at the same time, I started my collection of baseball memorabilia.
Right.
Because I was learning so much about the game. I'd be doing so much history reading to be able to write these letters that before I knew it, I had the ball that went through Buckner's legs. And I mean, it was crazy. I was involved in these auctions and trades, and baseball became like a very big part of my life. And boy, that was so much fun.
That whole period, I know, was a lot of fun for you. Now, you always loved baseball, right? Who was your team growing up?
Well, in the 60s, the late 60s, when, you know, you're really getting introduced to the game.
Right.
You know, about 7, 8, 9, 10 is when you really start to solidify a team. It begins for you, you know. That's when the 69 Mets were really, they were such a joy, you know, because, I mean, I really remember where I was when the Black Cat came in, you know, and Seaver was pitching, and we were against the Cubs and the whole thing. And those were the days that if you had a color TV, you know, the tube always went dead and somebody had to get up. There were no remotes. You had to bang on the TV, the side of the TV, and bring that picture back and, you know, all that fun stuff. And I loved that team. And as the Yankees started getting good in the late 70s, I really had an affinity for that team, too. There are certain characters of certain teams that you just like, and I just happen to like the characters of those teams.
Both those teams, and they did have a lot of interesting characters, and a lot of characters that meshed on the field, but were very different personality-wise.
Yes.
The Yankees, especially with Jackson, Catfish Hunter, Billy Martin managing.
And Goose Gossage, you know, who they bring him in the seventh inning, he pitched three innings.
Right.
And, boy, you know, you never knew if he was going to just... You never knew where his ball was going to go, but you know it was going to be fast. And I loved that, you know. I asked him in a letter that he wrote back if he remembered that at-bat versus Yaz in that playoff game, the Bucky Dent game.
Yes.
And he said when he was so pumped up to come in, and when Nettles caught the ball at the end, you know, when the basket catch came
out. That's
right. Yeah. He was like... He really thought that Nettles was going to drop that ball. I mean, he was very nervous. I mean, he looked at it, and that was, you know, not a... It looked smoother than it actually was, you know. But it was just to be able to talk with those guys.
Right.
You know, and I did a memorabilia show. I was going for a memorabilia auction-type thing in New Jersey. I fly into Philadelphia, and... it was snowing like crazy, so nobody could get a cab. And I'm trying to get a cab, and a couple of guys were in a cab, and they were saying, "Hey, where are you going?" I said, "I'm going down to Atlantic City." He said, "Well, jump in. We're going to Atlantic City too." And it turns out that it was Brian Doyle, the you know, the MVP
second baseman,
for the Yankees in '78.
Mm-hmm.
It was him and Bucky Dent that just kind of lit it up, and Oscar Gamble. You know, so it was like, we're in the car, and I'm saying, tell me about Reggie. What was he really like in the club? I mean, I shared a ride with some of my guys, you know what I mean, from my favorite team.
It's a dream come true for a lot of people.
I'm just telling you, it's those kind of things. When you put yourself in situations where you're having fun, great things happen.
That's right. That's right. Positivity. We were talking off air about some of the changes in the game today. And when you mentioned Goose Gossage pitching three innings, I thought about that.
Yeah.
The role of the closer now, in a lot of cases, to get one out.
Yeah.
And other changes to baseball that I'll be just straight blunt about this. In my point of view, it could ruin the game. I'm talking about the Chase Utley rule specifically. Oh, yeah. How did you feel about that when that happened?
Well, I felt terrible for Chase Utley, and I was rooting hard for the Mets. You know, and I remember thinking to myself, you know, this is ridiculous. This guy, the Dodgers were not playing well. The Mets pitchers were just on fire.
They were dominating. Yeah.
They were dominating. And Chase Utley is an old-time player. You could have stuck him in a Brooklyn Dodger uniform or a Brooklyn Robins uniform.
Yes.
In 1916.
Right.
And he would have done that same thing. He's a throwback, and he's a hard-nosed player. And he went into second base, not meaning to hurt a guy, meaning to fire up his team and get to second base.
Right. It's called breaking up the double play.
It's called breaking up the double play, right, and hard-nosed baseball.
Right.
But, you know, I would call it maybe soft-nosed baseball now, because there's so many rules about what you can and can't do.
Right.
You know, it goes into the Buster Posey rule. You know, now you got to be out of the baseline. And I mean, you shouldn't have guys having to think. The fun of baseball, the great thing about baseball, is there are two guys usually that both think they own something.
Right.
And who's going to win? The guy who's barreling down from third base to try to score, and the catcher. The catcher thinks he owns that piece of real estate right there.
Yes.
And the guy running to try to score thinks he owns it. Pete Rose.
Right.
Ray Fosse.
Right.
Come on. Who's going to, you know. And there are very few injuries when everything is said and done.
Right.
And it's the same as, you know, the rules with some guy throws inside right now, and he gets a warning.
Right.
The whole point of baseball is that little tiny piece of real estate. It's small, and it's the inside corner of the plate.
Right.
That's where the game happens. And the pitchers say, I own that.
Right.
And the batters say, no, I own it. But the batters now have a tremendous advantage. They have the umpires on their side, because the umpires have to call it. You know, if it's anywhere close, you know,
right.
God forbid that it knocks somebody down. You know, God forbid.
Right.
And they now wear, you know, arm braces and all these, or I should say arm protectors,
right,
and things like that.
Body armor.
That's right. And
yeah.
So they say, oh, he threw at the guy and stuff like that. These people don't know what throwing at people are. When you talk about the game with the Bob Gibsons and the Don Drysdales, ask Frank Robinson.
That's right.
Frank Robinson lived on the plate,
right,
because when they played the Dodgers, he wasn't happy he had to play against Don Drysdale. But hey, that was the mano a mano of that particular, you know, of that rivalry.
Right.
And that's what was so great about it.
Yeah, and we don't see those kind of challenges today between pitcher and batter as we did in that era.
And absolutely.
You and I are from the same era. We're pretty close to the same age, and we saw those same things. Like you mentioned, Bob Gibson. Many players who batted against him have told me stories about what happened. If they crowded the plate, or even if they hit a home run off,
yeah,
in,
oh, yeah,
one game. Tommy Davis told me a story.
Oh, yeah.
He hit a game-winning home run off Gibson. Was at a restaurant with his wife a couple nights later, and Gibson happened to be there. And the wife said, after they were introduced, oh, this is the guy you hit the home run off to win the game. And Tommy said to me, I dropped my head immediately because I knew I was going down the next time I faced him. And sure enough, it happened.
They all knew it.
Right.
They knew it.
But that is over with today.
Yes. It's very, very true. Yeah, I mean, they've taken all the testosterone out of the game. You know what?
Great way to put it.
Yeah, right. That's really kind of, that's what they, you know, I don't think they realize what they're doing. And I'll go a step further. I am absolutely dead set against, if you made me commissioner of baseball tomorrow, number one, right out of the box, kill video replay. I don't care who loses their jobs, how many video cameras have to be trashed, it doesn't matter.
Right.
That's not why you go to the ballpark. I could sit at home, and what am I going to do? I'm watching people mill about while they make a decision that takes 10 minutes,
right,
and then they complain that the game takes too long. It's because of Major League Baseball the game takes too long.
Right.
But they blame pitchers, and they blame other guys. You know, now they want to make a rule that the pitcher has to shorten the amount of,
right,
time between pitchers. That's ridiculous. And the other thing is, it's like the great thing about baseball is it's human. It reflects the way we normally live. Look, there are 9 innings. We live these days about 80 or 90 years. So each inning is kind of a decade.
That's right.
You know? The
great
game
way to look at it,
yeah. The game is very human. I don't mind if it makes a bad call against my team. I know I'll make it up somewhere.
Right. It always evens out.
Yes. And it makes you maybe a little bit angry.
Right.
As your team. Your team is going
right,
to figure out a way to overcome That's part of life to overcome.
Yes, it is.
You know, sometimes you get fired from a job and it's not fair. Well, you deal with it.
Right.
You know, but baseball's all like, oh, no, 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 let's go back and relive and relook. And you still can't even tell half the time.
Right. You're right.
It's not as enjoyable a game because of that.
Yeah. We're going to go to a station break, Seth. When we come back, I want to talk about the third book in the trilogy. And we'll talk some more about today's players versus yesterday's players back in our time. But for the moment, we'll go to station break. This is Eric Lindenberg with Seth Swirsky, and we will be right back.
Doc's Clubhouse, blogtalkradio.com.
Phoenix listeners and listeners visiting Phoenix, for the best sports bar experience in town, it's Brennan's Pub, 34th Street and Bell Road in Phoenix. The best sports bar, dining experience, and atmosphere you will find in the Valley. For great food, great scenery, all of your favorite sports teams on the big screen TVs. Happy hour Monday through Friday from 3 to 7 p.m. And Saturday-Sunday happy hour from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. Good food, good people, good times. That's Brennan's Pub.
Hi, this is Seth Swirsky, and you are in the clubhouse with the Doctor of Baseball. And so am I, only on blogtalkradio.com.
Doc's Clubhouse with Eric Lindenberg, the Doctor of Baseball.
And we are back with Seth Swirsky today. Seth, we've been talking about changes to the game and so many things and how people look at the game. And your third book, Something to Write Home About, was all about how people look at the game and people that most fans didn't realize had a tie or connection to baseball. How did that come about?
Well, after Baseball Letters had success, I was asked to do that second book, and then it became Every Pitcher Tells a Story, right, as I mentioned. And then, you know, they said, well, can you make it a trilogy? But I didn't want it to just be more players, because I kind of, you know, I kind of covered everything I wanted.
Right, right.
And I need to be excited about what I'm doing to do it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I just thought there are a lot of people out there that probably have neat baseball stories. And so before I knew it, I wrote a letter to President George W. Bush while he was in office.
Right.
He was only in office for about 6 months at the time. And unbeknownst to me, I get a manila envelope back. Sorry. And out pours 3 pages of a handwritten letter, and on White House stationery, and I, you know, written in the Oval Office.
I mean, you had to be excited about that.
Absolutely incredible, more than excited.
Right.
And he's writing about how he loved playing Little League baseball, but he was turned on to the game by his dad, who was the Yale first baseman, right, in the 40s.
Right.
And he goes through it was a fantastic letter. And it was very thrilling, obviously, and it's in Something to Write Home About, the third book. And I thought, well, you know, maybe I'll write to his dad, George H.W. Bush. And wouldn't you know, I got a letter back from him talking about how he presented Babe Ruth with an award as the Yale captain in his uniform. So that was amazing. I thought, well, I don't want people who are, maybe they don't like Republicans too much, so maybe I'll write to a prominent Democrat. So I wrote a letter to Ted Kennedy, Senator Kennedy. And he wrote this fantastic letter about loving the 67 Red Sox and going to the games with his dad and I should say his brothers, right, and just meeting certain. It was amazing. It was amazing.
Well, and these are people that the average fan and my listeners would never connect with baseball.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the most profound things about that book. Every page you turn, you don't know who you're going to see talking about baseball. Martin Luther King.
Oh, yes. Well, I found his official photographer, and he told me this fantastic story about how, you know, Martin Luther King was talking, you know, he was giving an interview one day, and he was around, and he said something like, this photographer was there, and he said something like, well, tell me about the civil rights, and he was, you know, going through the things that Martin Luther King was known for at the time. Martin Luther King said, no, I want to talk about baseball. And he took him into the backyard and he started to throw a ball to his son. And he gave me this photographer who wrote this all out, this incredible letter, Martin Luther King playing baseball. Right. I would have thought it. And he showed me the outtakes. And he let me use them in the book of Martin Luther King throwing a baseball, pitching to his son. And the beauty of it is that dads and sons are eternal in American life.
Right.
And it doesn't matter what your calling is and what your job is and what you do. Dads pitch to their sons.
That's right. Well, think about the ending of Field of Dreams.
Absolutely.
The climax of that movie.
And here was one of the great Americans of our age, really. Mm-hmm. And here he just was as a dad with a son. It was so beautiful to me. I loved it. It's one of those letters. And then, again, you know, I see Paul McCartney on TV. You know, he was a big Yankees fan at the time and became friends with Bernie Williams and all this stuff. And he's cheering at a game. And all of a sudden, in the seventh inning stretch, they're playing I Saw Her Standing There, one of the Beatles' big hits at the beginning that Paul wrote. And I decided, hey, you know, why not? Let me give it a try. You know, you can't be afraid. You got to just go for it.
That's
and go
right.
big, you know. And I called up his lawyer's office and got a secretary on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
And I told her my story. And she said, I'll see what I can do. But, you know, he's very busy and he's in London and we're in New York and all the things. I'm telling you, it wasn't a week later. And I get a handwritten letter back from Paul McCartney. And it starts, Dear Seth. I'm thinking, Dear Seth from Paul McCartney. And then he's saying, he says something like, yeah, I remember that game. And I'm thinking, Paul McCartney writing the word yeah. Like, one time in 1963, he wrote, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, you know what I mean?
This is a guy and the big word of the Beatles. You know what I mean? So, I mean, you know, two paragraphs. You're getting a letter from Paul McCartney. It's pretty, you know, personal letter.
Yes.
About baseball. So, you know, that's what Something to Write Home About was basically about. And there were other great players in the book as well.
Right.
Of the past and current players. But it was just a joy.
You know, we talked before, another time you and I were having just a personal conversation. We talked about baseball and music and how the two things are tied together so tightly that we can't conceive of going to a baseball game without hearing classic music.
Yes.
And Beatles music specifically. I went to a game last year and heard songs that were not the big hits. They were not the Hey Judes. Songs that were obscure for a Beatles song to be obscure. Have you had that experience?
Yes. I'll say two things about that. One is I could be watching a baseball game in Arizona versus Philadelphia in early June, a game that's not being covered widely.
Right.
Okay. And it comes up on the seventh inning stretch, and then I'm hearing the organist playing Sexy Sadie. Okay. They're not playing Hey Jude. They're not playing I Want to Hold Your Hand. They're playing Sexy Sadie. And that goes to what you were saying. I mean, even those tertiary songs, even the ones that are deep in, they're not the first ones you think of.
Right.
And it, to me, just to make a side comment about the Beatles, the reason they're going to last for 500 years or more, the reason they're going to go on is because it's just like when the rocket went to the moon, when we went to the moon. It took three stages. Three-stage rocket.
Right.
It blasted off, and then you saw that stage just fall to the Earth.
Right.
And then that second stage sent it to the moon.
Right.
And the Beatles had all those big hits at the beginning. I mean, obviously, throughout their career, had a number of big hits. That was the main booster rocket. And the second booster was all those secondary hits, which were like still huge, but they maybe weren't number one. But still, what? Everybody still thinks of them as number one because they were, you know. And they just had so many layers. I think of them as booster rockets.
That's a great analogy. Really is. We're going to go to another station break, Seth. And when we come back, I want to touch on a couple other things we haven't talked about yet. And we will be right back.
Doc's Clubhouse. blogtalkradio.com.
We have a job to do out here today.
To be a winning team, you have to work like a winning team.
My team depends on me.
And my team is 50,000 strong.
This is the Action Team. High school students and Major League Baseball players working together to train and inspire the next generation of volunteers.
I'm LaTroy Hawkins.
I'm Craig Kimbrell.
And we're
We're on the team.
The action team.
Our team is the action team. Get in on the action at actionteam.org. Are you in?
Hi, this is John DiAquisto. You're listening to Doc's Clubhouse on BTR Radio.
Doc's Clubhouse with Eric Lineberg, the doctor of baseball.
And we are back with Seth Sworsky. And Seth, before that last break, we were talking about baseball and music and how they meld together. And a lot of people will say baseball is life. Other people say music is life. How do you feel about them both being life?
Well, you know, anything that you feel passionate about is life.
Right.
You know, I noticed that when I'm enjoying the moment, when a song like Martha, My Dear comes on the radio,
right,
and I'm singing at the top of my lungs in my car,
mm-hmm,
I always end up saying to myself, this is life. If I'm at a baseball game and a ball gets, you know, even a foul ball gets hit in that row of, and kids are jumping with their mitts and all that stuff, I actually say out loud to myself, this is life.
Right.
These are the moments. These are the moments of that make up your life.
Right.
So, you know, people always talk about living in the now, but you got to acknowledge the now.
That's a great point. Yeah.
You know, you got to really say, I feel really good right now.
Right.
I say it out loud. I actually say it out loud. And sometimes, you know, people say, what? Are you talking to yourself? I don't say it super loud, but,
right,
you know, little moments, you know, if I'm in the waves at the beach, I think, what a feeling. The waves are hitting me and the sun's coming down. This
right.
is life.
This is life.
Yeah. So when you talk about music and you talk about baseball, you're there at a game for a reason. You're
right.
listening to the music that you like for a reason.
Right.
I always just try to acknowledge it.
Good point. We are running out of time, Seth, and I have so much more I want to talk with you about, and I know our listeners want to hear more. Can we stay together here in the clubhouse for a while and do another show, and we'll put them back to back?
Oh, that would be fun. Absolutely.
Okay, well, we are going to do that. For part one with Seth Sworsky, this is Eric Lineberg, the doctor of baseball. I want to thank Sal DeGuardia, our producer, thank all of our advertisers. And yes, listeners, we are going to return with Seth Sworsky. And we will talk with you soon.
Thank you for subscribing to Doc's Clubhouse. New shows every Friday, only on blogtalkradio.com.